in our campaign, we did not ignore anybody. We gave an opportunity for anybody to get on board. And so we had the guy who was a Bernie person or who believed in Bernie that couldn't vote. He was there, you know, on the ground working hard. Like, we had a biker for Trump, you know, that couldn't vote. He was on the ground working hard for Amendment 4. And when you think about it, how could we get people to not vote against their own self-interest? That's what we did. That was the question that people have been asking for years.
That's the voice of Desmond Mead, a prominent organizer in Florida who led a successful campaign in the state to repeal a Jim Crow era law that banned people with felony convictions from voting. In this episode of Who Belongs, Desmond described some of the strategies his campaign used to gain public support for the repeal of that law through a state ballot initiative this past November, which led to about 1.4 million people regaining their right to vote. This is also the first episode in a series of shows we're recording in collaboration with the Civic Engagement Narrative Change Project here at the Haas Institute, which will be highlighting work people are doing around the country to help activate civic participation. I'm Mark Abizade, one of the hosts of Who Belongs, and this was our conversation with organizer Desmond Mead. Well, first of all, Desmond Mead, welcome to Berkeley and welcome to our podcast, Who Belongs.
Thank you for having me.
Desmond, you're the president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which for years has been campaigning to repeal a law that's more than 100 years old that restricts people who have felony convictions and served their time and then completed their sentences from voting. And you won. Last November, you had a referendum on the ballot, and it won more than 60%, which is what it needed. And you guys got that law repealed. So can you start by telling us a little bit about that amendment called Amendment 4, about what it entails, who it affects, et cetera?
Well, that's great. So, yeah, that law has actually been in effect in Florida for like over 150 years. And we know the history of felon disenfranchisement, where newly freed slaves were, these codes were created, or these Jim Crow laws were created to diminish the newfound political clout of the recently freed slaves. And so for years, Florida has, held on to these policies. And, you know, over the last several years, Florida became only one of four states that still practice this permanently disenfranchising American citizens. And it was the worst at one point at its height, over 1.68 million Floridians could not vote because of a prior felony conviction, and we accounted for at least a quarter of the total population of folks in the entire states who couldn't vote. And so what Amendment 4 did was it sought to create an alternative pathway for a person to regain voting rights. And what it did was it allowed for the removal of the disqualification from voting from people with felony convictions once they've completely served their time. Unfortunately, we had some carve-outs, and so people who are convicted of murder and people who are convicted of any felony sexual offense would not benefit from this, you know, alternative pathway, but they weren't foreclosed from the standard route. But we looked into it, and we had to go forward, you know, and so we, this amendment if eventually just freed at least 1.4 million folks and allowed them to really regain their citizenship status.
And when does it take effect, and what do you see as far as implementation of the amendment?
So, you know, the amendment has already taken effect on January 8th. People, myself included, was able to walk into our local supervisor of elections office and register to vote. And within a matter of days, people have started getting their voter registration cards in the mail, so which is a great thing. You know, but I want to step back for a second, because I want to talk about what happened on November 6th on election night. You know, I believe First of all, we had over 5.1 million people in Florida that voted yes on our referendum, Amendment 4. And that was over a million more votes than any candidate received that was on the ballot. And so we, you know, the two main gubernatorial candidates was Ron DeSantis and Andrew Gillum. And, you know, we had so many votes that one thing that we knew was that at least 1 million people who voted for Ron DeSantis also voted for Amendment 4. And what I love to tell people and what excites me, you know, I'm like I'm excited at the fact that 1.4 million people was able to get their voting rights back. But I'm even more excited about how we were able to do it. And so when I looked at those 5.1 million votes, I seen that those votes were not votes that was based on fear or hate, but rather they were 5.1 million votes that were based on love, forgiveness, and redemption. And I think that this country and the state of Florida, but for a few moments on election night, got to witness love actually winning the day. You know, and I thought that that was beautiful because we were able to take a politically volatile issue in a politically volatile state, right, during a volatile climate, right, that was a political climate, and we were able to win with no opposition, right, and we surpassed our 60% threshold by 5 percentage points, so we was at 65, and we were able to actually move a major policy piece. And it was supported by people from all walks of life, all racial backgrounds, all political persuasions.
And that's reflected inside the coalition as well. I mean, you mentioned it got like 65% approval. So mm-hmm. nearly two-thirds of the voters who voted in favor of Amendment 4,
yeah.
which shows you that it has support both on the left and the right. It's yeah. not just a progressive cause.
Yeah.
And in fact, in your coalition, you had, I think, the director, the political director. He's actually a Republican, isn't he?
Yes.
He's profiled in the New York Times. He used to be a lobbyist. He went to jail for corruption.
Yep.
He came out. He was disenfranchised, and he got involved with you. So can you talk a little bit about that and about that strategy of bringing in people from the other side?
Well, so that was a strategy that actually was developed by just being on the ground, right? And so I'm a strong advocate. You know, I've now that I've gone through this ballot initiative, I could tell you it is so important to really be connected to what's happening on the ground, because we could lose sight if we're far removed from what's happening. We could actually really lose sight of the essence of what's moving issues. And so with me, you know, when I first came into advocacy around, you know, felon disenfranchisement, you know, hey, I knew what the narrative was, you know, how it disproportionately impacts African American, you know, and I, you know, fed into that narrative, right? And that was something that was a legitimate focus about the disproportionate impact on African Americans, but what I didn't know at the time was that it inadvertently created a narrative that created a false illusion. That was a false illusion that really made this an African-American issue. So people would think, oh, it's only impacting African-Americans. And because it's only impacting African-Americans, definitely no Republicans are going to be for it because African-Americans vote for Democrat, right? And so it fed into these narratives that, oh, yeah, it's a black issue and Republicans are against it, right? When I'm hitting the road in Florida, the first thing that I'm seeing is that, wait a minute, number one is that I'm running across people who are not don't look like me and not even Democrats. That, and I'm realizing that, wait a minute, this thing is actually, it impacts people from all walks of life, from all political persuasions. And what stood out more to me than anything else was that just hearing those stories had really touched my heart, and there was a human rights element to this, a human rights element that transcend partisan or the all of these different labels that we, you know, whether progressive, conservative, far left, far right, all that. Wait a minute, what about humanity, you know? And so being able to travel the state and talking to real people, right, and hearing the stories, just really amplified that. Wait a minute, this is more of, there's a more human message to this than any other kind of message that was out there. And I just happened to run across Neil Vogts one day. I was speaking at a school, one of the colleges down there in Southwest Florida, and he was able to identify with what I was talking about. And you know, he liked to tell people, he thought he was going to be the only fire hydrant at an all dog show, right? But he felt comfortable with my conversation. So my conversation wasn't railing against Republicans or conservatives. I wasn't railing against white people. I was railing for humans, anything, right? Railing against a system that is now originally intended for me, or to deprive me of the right to vote, but like a tumor, when left unchecked, it spread to the rest of the body. So now it's impacting everybody. And I made it a we issue instead of a my issue, right? And because of that, people were able to buy into that. People were able to invest themselves, right? So I created, and what essentially happened was, I didn't start out already limiting myself, who I am, limiting the cause, and limiting who can help me, mm-hmm. right, or who can support. I started out in such a way where everybody was able to be a part of this. And because of that, people like Neil were able to be in meetings and say, hey, this is my problem too, mm-hmm. right? And I want to be a part of the solution. And I can bring my family and my friends and my network to the solution. And that's essentially what happened, was that you got an organic grassroots movement from people from all over that just was able to transcend race and politics.
How many other states in the country are also affected by similar laws that restrict, that disenfranchise people?
Well, I think the majority of states, I would say, virtually say about 48 of the states, have some type of law policy on the book that would disenfranchise a person at some point. There are two states that don't, Maine and Vermont. You never lose your right to vote. But then the other 44 states, they have a pathway, a very clear pathway for an individual to navigate the way he's able to earn the right to vote back. There were four states, Kentucky, Iowa, Virginia, and Florida, that permanently disenfranchised a person. And the only way that they could have gotten their civil rights back, or voting rights is included in that packet, was to petition the governor. And if the governor decided that he wanted to or she wanted to, then that would happen. But clemency is not a right. You know, and the governor could essentially just say, you know what, I'm not pardoning, I'm not going to pardon anyone. I'm not going to give anyone clemency. And that's that. And there was nothing that you could do about it. And so we had to create another way to end that permanent disenfranchisement. So now that we have Florida off of the books, we have three states remaining. And then just recently we've heard that Iowa's governor now is contemplating placing an amendment on the ballot that would lift that ban for former felons.
Now, you have a law degree. You graduated uh-huh. from Florida.
Florida International University College of Law.
Now, but one thing you said in the past mm-hmm. is that even though you have that degree, mm-hmm. you actually can't sit for the bar. Is that still the case even
that
after?
That is still the case now, because what this amendment dealt with was only voting rights. And so there is still a civil rights restoration requirement that I have to fulfill in order for me to apply to the Florida bar.
But there's a host of other things too, aside from voting and aside from sitting yeah. for the bar. Can you talk about some of the other restrictions?
Yeah, so the immediate in-your-face restrictions are, I can't sit on a jury and I can't run for office. Those are like the immediate, right, in-your-face, this is it. But then there are other collateral consequences. There are occupational license restrictions. So there are certain occupational licenses I won't be able to get until my civil rights have been restored. There's housing restrictions in certain subdivisions in the state of Florida. You have like homeowners associations that have written within their bylaws provisions that will prevent me from owning or even renting a home in that subdivision unless my civil rights have been restored. You know, and so, like, you know, we, you know, in the state of Florida, I think we, a person with a felony conviction faces over 235 different collateral consequences that's associated with that.
Yeah, so these laws, they're most egregious in some of those states that you mentioned, like Florida and Kentucky and Virginia, because of the disproportionate impact they have on black people.
Yeah.
And there's a historical reason for that. It goes back to Jim Crow. Yeah. It goes back to the...
So one of the things that, you know, we used to highlight back in the days was how the laws was tailored, all right? The laws that limited your access to a lot of benefits was tailored towards the type of crimes that folks believe that African Americans would commit. And so, for instance, in Alabama, when these Jim Crow laws came about, a person would lose their voting rights for hitting their wife, but they wouldn't lose it for killing their wife, you know, because the white person was more likely to kill their wife and the black person was more likely to hit them. So the laws that disenfranchise a person were ones that they would expect African Americans or the newly released slaves to actually commit. That's just our history. You know, I think that, you know, most of the states have taken steps to kind of erase that path, that past. I'm hoping and I'm believing that with this recent win in Florida that we can take some more steps towards actually dealing with the restoration of civil rights. I would love to have something like Maine and Vermont where you never lose your rights.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like Canada. Yeah. So if you want to make a comparison to Canada, you can vote even if you're in prison, the same with Maine and Vermont. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you gotta finish your sentence and then you gotta go through some process. It's even when you're still in prison, they give you registration cards, they give you voting election material, they encourage you to vote. Whereas here, and it's countrywide. Yeah. It's not up to the provinces. Whereas in the U.S., it's up to the states.
Yep.
And so how come now someone that has a, this might be a good question because you have a law degree, I want to know, because of the history of these laws, especially in the South, and you can see the effects, that it was, they were clearly designed to be able to exclude black people from voting and participating in civic life, from serving on juries. Now this is historical and contemporary. You can see it still have the same effects today. So why isn't these types of laws in the South and across the country a violation of federal laws that outlaw discrimination based on race, things like the Civil Rights Act and things like the 14th Amendment? Can't you make a case? You have the evidence to show?
But we have. But here's the thing. We have made the case, and it's been substantiated before the United Nations, that we are in violation. A lot of our laws are in violation of human rights, and I can't recall the name of the treaty, the particular treaty that the United States is a signatory to, but they're in violation of this like human rights accord because of these type of laws like around felony disenfranchisement. You know, a few years back, I personally went to the United Nations to testify about this issue. So the violation is there. Whether or not the United States want to do anything about it is a different story. So this is even when President Obama was in office. Okay, so let's be real with this. There was not an appetite to change that, partially because, you know, there is a separation. You know, state rights versus federal rights, right? And that a lot of the power rests within the state, and it's a hard uphill battle, you know, to do something otherwise. And so it's really up to the states to change that, to have the willpower to do so. And if it's up to the states, that means that the power of each state rests within the people, and it's the people that have to wrest that power away from elected officials. And that's what we were able to do in Florida, because at some point, you know, we had to say that this has been in the politicians' court for far too long. They didn't have the political willpower to do anything about it. So we had to take matters into our own hands. And that's what we did. We said, we know this is wrong, and you don't want to fix it, so we're going to fix it for you.
Now, you, I mean, you can't sue. I mean, you can't bring these kinds of cases as an organizer and as a someone with a law degree.
Well, as an organizer, I wouldn't want to sue, believe it or not.
Why?
Because I think there's a better way than suing. You know, because I could sue and I could win, but to me, that's a hollow win. Compared to I could organize on the ground and we could change the law ourselves, and now there's more people invested in that, you know. So you could feed a hungry man, you know, a fish today, he's going to be hungry tomorrow. But if you teach a hungry man how to fish, he'd never have to be hungry, right? Me filing a lawsuit is just feeding a hungry man. You know, me organizing a ballot initiative is teaching a bunch of hungry men how to fish. And now you have a movement.
So then what's next for the movement?
Wow, that's a great question, right? I believe that, so there's a couple things there, man. And it's, you know, it requires courage. And that's something, that's a word that I've been using a lot of lately because, you know, one of the hardest things for us to do is actually self-reflect. And we have to be courageous enough to do it. It is so easy for us to point the finger at other people and talk about how, you know, morally bankrupt they are or what they're doing wrong, and, you know. But how often do we look at ourselves and see what role have we played in the situation and what can we do to make things better? And so I use that word courage because that's what it took for us to win. You know, the courage to know that, hey, wait a minute, we've been doing certain things a certain way for so long and it is netting us nothing, then we need to change. And it's hard for people to admit, man, I was wrong. Yes, I invested a ton of money into this and time, but I was wrong. We need to do something different. They wouldn't say that. They would say, oh, it's because of that person why we were. No, the plan was flawed to begin with, right? And so when you talk about what's next, I think being courageous enough to do some self-reflection, all right, and to be able to really grasp that, number one, our systems are broken, right? And we do not need to have broken, contaminated systems absorb this new set group of voters, right? That we have an opportunity to actually shake up the status quo and to try to at least hit the reset button, you know, about getting things done in this country, because we have just, my God, just gone, we've been going down the drain, and our division and fractures in our country has just been getting wider and wider and wider, and there's more hate out there, there's more fear out there, you know, and I think this little old campaign called Amendment 4, Second Chances campaign, came around and showed that, man, we could win something with love instead of hate and fear, right? And that people can come together along the lines of humanity, right? And I think that we have an opportunity, what next, to really set a new trend, to really start to turn this cruise ship around, because you just can't turn it around in a drop of a dime, but at least we can start that process. And I'm looking at this campaign as being one of those influences that could start turning this ship around and shake up the status quo. You know, when I tell people is that I worked too hard and waited too long to get my voting rights back to just give it away to anybody, right? And what that's saying is that both sides need to now straighten up, really come out of whatever funk they've been in all these years, and really find their way back to being the representatives of the people like they were originally intended to do, right? And not representatives of a party, right? And not representatives of special interests, because both of those are contaminating forces. You know, you're talking about being a representative of people, right? And getting back to the issues that impact people and not the issues that impact parties. You know what I'm saying? And I think that we have an opportunity to really start shaping, dictating, I should say, the conversation you know, around those things.
Are you going to be looking at other issues in Florida? Are you thinking about spreading the campaign to other states that have these same kind of laws?
Well, you know, if other states want to get the secret sauce, they can always reach out to them because it's a secret sauce. You know, hey, I mean, and I tell folks all the time, I've seen so many people invest so much time and resources into things that never panned out for year after year after year after year after year. You know, we happen to be successful. There's a secret sauce there. I've given away one of the secrets. I operate and organize around love. All right, that's one of them. I can't give them all away, you know? They got to come and talk. If they want me in the state, they have to come and talk to me. You know, but when you talk about, you know, people ask me, well, Desmond, does this shake up the political landscape? I said, no, I think it more than anything, it shakes up policy, right? Because even with my organization, we tell folks, listen, we don't lean left or right. We lean straight forward into the issues that impact people with felony convictions and their family members, right? And so what we're most concerned about is criminal justice reform. We're most concerned about reentry reform, right? That, listen, we want to make sure that there's a fair and humane criminal justice system. And then we also want to make sure that when people are punished, right, after they've completed their punishment, that they're given every opportunity possible to successfully reintegrate back into their community. Because if they do so, it's better for everybody, right? Because if I get out of jail and I can't find a job and I can't find a place to live and I can't get an education, chances are I'm going to go back to doing the things that got me in jail the first time. And if I do that, then more than likely you might end up being my victim, right? And while you're my victim, then you're going to still end up, your tax dollars is going to end up paying for me when it could have been going to educating your child, it could have been going for your health care, could have been going for public safety, but now it's going towards keeping me locked up when we didn't even have to go that route by me being able, if I was able to get a job, education, whatever. And so we are firmly committed to finding creative ways to enhance the likelihood of people successfully reentering into their community and being a part of the solution instead of part of the problem. And the overwhelming majority of us, and when I'm saying us, I'm talking about people with felony convictions, that's what we're doing. You know, we're doing that on a daily basis.
I want to ask one more question that's related to that about coming out of prison. About now, you have a term you've adopted within the movement, within the coalition, returning citizen. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that kind of strikes me about that term is there's an idea about a citizen, about what entails a citizen. Citizens have certain duties, among them are voting, serving on juries, participating in power. Mm-hmm. But when you come out of prison, you find yourself not able to do any of that. Do you really feel like a citizen, like you are a returning citizen? Or do you feel like, you know, it's something else, like you no longer belong?
Well, now we are in Florida.
Yeah, now you
now
are.
Now we are, because once we do our time, we get the right to vote back. But let me tell you, I think it was a group out of D.C., Washington, D.C., that actually originated that term, returning citizen. We came up with it in Florida, not because of what we didn't hear. We didn't know about it before. The only reason we came up with it, because when we were trying to organize and we wanted to have these rallies, someone sent me a study that was done by someone at Florida State University in their criminology doctoral program, which happens to be their criminal justice program is, I heard, one of the top programs in the world. And the study was called Labeling, and basically what it said was that if you call somebody an ex-felon, convict, you know, offender, that you increase the likelihood of them recidivating, you know. And it reminded me of when we used to hear, like, a doctor say that if you keep calling a child stupid while they're growing up, they're going to eventually do what? They're going to think that, okay, I am stupid, right? And so we was like, well, wait a minute. Let us try to find what kind of positive energy can we put into the atmosphere to identify people with felony convictions. And the best thing we could come up with was returning citizens. That regardless of the fact that we were stripped of the right to vote, we were citizens of our community, our state, that made mistakes, and we were coming back into our community. And that's where we, that's how we came up with the term returning citizen, not knowing that someone had beat us to the punch, God knows how long before. But that was our reasoning behind it. And we wanted people to speak of themselves in a positive way and not what someone else has defined, but how we define ourselves. And that's why we use the term returning citizen. We can actually say that we are now in Florida. We are returned citizens because now, like I said, I went in and I registered to vote on January 8th, and so many other folks did. I want to say that even that day was a celebration. It was a celebration of love because the people whose vote of love helped pass Amendment 4 showed up at the Supervisor of Elections office with us to experience and witness us really filling out those applications. And then it was also a celebration of expanding democracy. You know, we've always said that a more inclusive democracy is a more vibrant democracy, and the more vibrant democracy is good for everybody. And so we fought just as hard for that person that wished he could have voted for Donald Trump as we did for that person that wanted to vote for Barack Obama. You know, because everyone, every American citizen should have the ability and the right to have their voice heard. And on January 8th, we came a long way from where we were to making that more of a reality than anything. And we're one step closer.
Desmond, what about voter registration drives to try to get some of these 1.4 million newly re-enfranchised people registered to vote?
There are so many people that want to rush out and register people, right? And that's something that, you know, we're really trying to talk people through, you know, and we tell them, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You're not going to rush out there and register 1.4 million returning citizens. And we don't want you to do it in the way that you think you want to do it, because then we're feeling like we're targeted, which now speaks to how do we engage people? What we do know is that in the United States, there's a high level of voter apathy that's there, right? And yeah, we register a lot of people, but then there's a ton of people that don't go out and vote, right? And I believe that part of that process is because of their first interaction with voting. And their first interaction with voting is with someone registering to vote. And what I caution people against is, and I can understand that there's the anxiety and there's that feeling of loss because some favorite candidates, you know, didn't win on election night. And so we want to right this wrong and we want to add more people to the voting roster and get people out there to vote so we don't have to suffer this win again. But when we go about it that way, we end up reducing a person's humanity to being just a vote, right? Now you're coming to register me, but I'm nobody to you. I'm just a vote. You don't even see my humanity, you know? And the thing about it is, if that's my first experience as a voter, then how enthused am I going to be? How motivated am I going to be to go out and vote? You know, I don't think that motivation level is going to be that high. And I think that that was something that we learned part of the lesson the hard way, because the people that we've been ignoring, somebody came along and started talking to them. You know, and because they talked to them, those people showed up because there was a void that was there that was deepening and deepening over all of the years of us ignoring people and just looking at people at numbers and not realizing that they're human beings with issues. In our campaign, we did not ignore anybody. We gave an opportunity for anybody to get on board. And so we had the guy who was a Bernie person or who believed in Bernie that couldn't vote. He was there, you know, on the ground working hard. Like, we had a biker for Trump, you know, that couldn't vote. He was on the ground working hard for Amendment 4. And when you think about it, how could we get people to not vote against their own self-interest? That's what we did. That was a question that people have been asking for years. They haven't figured that out. We have. We figured that out. And so while there is a natural tendency to want to rush out and vote. You know, I'm like, listen, slow down. What you want to do? You want to rush out there and register a million people and only have 100,000 of them show up to the polls? Or do you want to go out there and register 600,000 of them and have 400,000 show up to the polls? What's more effective? You know, I think that I want to have more people engaged, because I do believe the more people that get to go and vote, the more accountable our elected officials are going to be, the more vibrant our democracy is going to be. And so I don't want to perpetuate a broken system, a system that's not as effective as it should be. I want to try something different, because what do we have to lose?
And that concludes our conversation with Desmond Mead, who is the president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. We'll have a transcript of this interview available on our website at hawesinstitute.berkeley.edu/whobelongs. There you can also find links to learn more about Desmond's work and the work of his coalition. Also, be sure to check us out on social media using the Institute's handle at Hawes Institute. Thank you for listening.